You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the 1980s, a new class of drugs was introduced to help dialysis patients cut down on blood transfusion. The miracle drugs, known collectively as erythropoietin-stimulating agents, or EPO, boosted the hemoglobin levels of anemics, offering them a chance to feel more invigorated. Kathleen Sharp, a print and broadcast journalist, has written a new book called Blood Feud that examines how the pharmaceutical company Johnson & Johnson aggressively marketed their EPO drug, Procrit, and as a result became embroiled in one of the costliest and deadliest prescription drug scandals in history. It's published by Dutton. I'm very pleased that it brings Kathleen Sharp to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Is this a case that you covered as a journalist?
Yes, it is. I started covering it for Vanity Fair and realized that there was a huge, great book in this story.
So tell us about EPO. Who created it?
EPO was one of the first biotech blockbusters, and it was created by Amgen, a huge company down in Southern California. And at the time, Amgen was a very tiny shop, and it needed marketing muscle. So it teamed up with Johnson & Johnson, which agreed to help push EPO through the regulatory channels. And in return, J&J took a part of the market.
Well, it was originally aimed at anemics. What does it do?
Well, what it does essentially is help your body build red blood cells, and that is what gives us the energy and the oxygen. In fact, a lot of bicyclists originally were getting EPO on the black market and injecting themselves so that they could climb those alpine hills. But it was only approved for dialysis patients and cancer patients undergoing chemotherapy. But over the years, both Amgen and J&J sort of illicitly and illegally expanded the market.
Well, how much hemoglobin is safe for the average person?
It depends on whether you're a man or a woman, but basically for men it's about 46, and for women it's about 36.
And if we have more than that, is that a problem?
It's a huge problem, because what happens is that our blood becomes so oxygenated that it turns to sludge, and then the heart has a real hard time pumping it through the body.
And what does EPO do? How does it create hemoglobin?
By multiplying your red blood cells, essentially.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So now I understand that for anemics, but I don't understand it for cancer.
Well, when you undergo chemotherapy, it's toxic, and it sucks a lot of your energy and red blood cells. So doctors and hospitals would inject chemotherapy patients with EPO to get them ready for the toxic treatments.
And that was considered to be a good thing?
It was, although I should mention that early on, the FDA told both Amgen and J&J to test the drug for safety in the large patient pools, and they never did.
Well, the law says that the leaves the testing to the drug companies, doesn't it?
It does.
The first one, 1938, established that, but then it was revised more recently?
Well, the problem with the FDA is that it is really toothless. You find that instead of being regulators, the regulated sort of step in and kind of co-opt the consumer agency.
Yeah, well, then why are so many people, at least Republican candidates, complaining about the FDA and saying they want to eliminate it? Because it's toothless, or because they see it as having some kind of regulatory strength?
Well, I don't know why the Republicans are against it, but I think all patients and consumers should really agitate for a strong FDA. And right now, as we're watching, you know, politics always trumps, or often trumps, the regulatory agency.
As we just saw with a decision yesterday.
Yeah, right.
Although the government's claiming that politics had nothing to do with it. It was protection of 10-year-olds. Tell us about Amgen, the company that invented this drug.
Well, Amgen was a very exciting company back in the 80s. It was sort of the dawn of biotech drugs. And Amgen had worked for many, many years to try and untangle the secret of this hormone. And when it did, it was really on its last leg. So J&J sort of helped save it and really revive it.
So J&J came in and created an alternative drug. Theirs, Amgen's, was called Epogen, and Johnson & Johnson had Procril.
Right, but they're basically the same.
Procrit, the same drug?
There's the same drug, just different brand names and different markets, which was really ludicrous, because how can you enforce different markets with the same drug?
But then there's a third company's name that comes into all of this, Ortho Biotech.
Well, Ortho Biotech is one of the 200 divisions of J&J, which, as we know, is a huge monolithic healthcare company. So once the scandal of Procrit began to hit the news, Ortho Biotech sort of ceased to exist and changed its names many times.
Now, there was an agreement between Amgen and Johnson & Johnson called a product license agreement. What did that determine?
That just simply determined that the two of them would be able to sell EPO in these different marketing arenas, J&J for cancer and Amgen for the dialysis.
But it was rather vague, wasn't it? So Johnson & Johnson could sell for dialysis and Amgen could sell for cancer?
Right. And they thought, you know, they'd walk down the aisle in this wonderful marriage hand in hand, but it became real clear that that marketing agreement was never going to work.
So then they found themselves in competition with each other?
Well, I'd say they found themselves in a really bitter fight, a blood feud, really, over this huge multi-billion-dollar drug.
Now, is a drug like this, which helps anemics and cuts down on dialysis, something that the government welcomes? Because isn't the government, by law, forced to pay for every dialysis treatment?
Well, that's a great point, Leonard. Medicare has been a real savior for this drug because dialysis patients, as you know, are pretty much covered under Medicare and Medicaid. So a lot of this drug was underwritten by public taxpayer money. And what happened, according to my two sources, these great sales reps for J&J, they were instructed to go out in the market and sort of sell EPO at a very low discount price, but teach the doctors how to bill at a high sticker price. And that even enriched, you know, the doctors even more.
So how much money per year since they were created in 1989 have these EPO drugs cost Medicare? Do we know?
About $60 billion over the last 15, 20 years.
So might better regulation of the market have saved the Medicare system a huge amount of money?
Well, indeed it has. In fact, just last June, the FDA announced that everyone should do everything they can to stay off of this drug. Yet here we have Medicare continuing to pay for it. So it's a huge amount of waste.
Now, why is, in this country, the evaluation of new drugs left to doctors?
Well, I'm not sure that the evaluation is left to doctors, but it's certainly left to the companies. And what you have is, a lot of us think that the FDA actually tests drugs, but they rely on the pharmaceutical companies to submit tests. And a lot of times these tests have holes in them or they're rather faulty. And the real tragedy with EPO is that the FDA continually asked both Amgen and J&J to test the drug for safety in big patient pools in 1993, 1996, 98, and even to this date, they still have not successfully tested it for safety.
My guest is Kathleen Sharp, who's written a book called Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. It is published by Dutton. Later we'll get to that man. But how did J&J work with oncologists to push Procrit into off-label use?
Well, what they would do would they'd sign up doctors to become their experts or to speak at other medical conventions about the great benefits of EPO. And amazingly enough, J&J actually started to increase the dosage to an illegal and very risky dose. And yet the doctors went along with it because they would get paid honorariums or go away on wonderful vacations with the wife. So they really earned money in order to help J&J increase the dosage.
And a key figure in all of this is Dr. John Glaspie.
Glaspie is
Who's
one
he?
Of them. John Glaspie is pretty noted, a well-noted oncologist down at UCLA, but you could name any noted oncologist at any Stanford, Harvard, all of them participated in this in some way or another.
Well, the reason I mentioned Glaspie is he published an article as recently as 2008 refuting the risks that EPO poses in cancer patients. He wrote, "The lack of definitive anemia has placed physicians, regulators, and most importantly, patients in a difficult position that can only be addressed with additional data."
Well, that's amazing because he worked both for Amgen and J&J to sort of make the high dosage the standard in the oncology community.
And the abstract actually contains a footnote stating that Dr. Glaspie has received research support from Amgen and Ortho Biotech.
Well, and how can patients and consumers know about these conflicts of interest? I mean, unless we're reading medical journals.
But I also wonder how competing pharmaceutical companies would fund the same doctor.
Well, they didn't at the same time, but what these doctors often did is play one company against the other to see how they could up the ante, so to speak. So Glaspie only worked for one at a time, but he certainly enjoyed the money from both partners.
So, okay, so we have these two companies in competition, but then they go a little further. They sue each other.
Oh, they were continually suing each other in what is called arbitration, sort of this private secret court. And one of the wonderful things about this project is that I was able to get a lot of the documents from those arbitrations, so you could really see the tit for tat that these two companies did. And they sued each other several times over 20 years.
And all sorts of odd names pop up. We mentioned biotech. What is Charisse Charles?
Ah, Charisse Charles.
Oh, Charisse.
Charisse, yes. It's a
I thought it was a person.
Well, actually, it's a company named after the man's wife. It's a beautiful name, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, there's so many middlemen in the healthcare industry, so many shadow companies. And one of these was a mail order pharmacy by the name of Charisse. And they were kind of drawn into this blood feud by siding with J&J against Amgen. And they would sell EPO for J&J because they got a better deal themselves.
But it sounds to me like the deal is the equivalent of money laundering.
Well, that's a great term for it. And indeed, it is. It's very, you know, and this is one reason why the healthcare system here in America is so expensive. You have all these people who are taking a cut, whether it's doctors, mail order pharmacies, and the poor patient is usually stuck with the highest price.
And we mentioned that we would come to the man who blew the whistle. His name is Mark Duxbury. How does he come into this story?
Well, he contacted me back in 2004 with this incredible tale of how J&J was sort of gaming the system. And at first, I didn't want to do the story. I thought, this is way too incredible to be true. But over the following 3 years, Mark continued to call, and he was very charming, like a salesman, and had great jokes. And he told me that, you know, soon this was going to boom into a really big story, which indeed it did.
Well, he was one of J&J's most successful salesmen, wasn't he?
He was indeed. He was a top star salesman, along with his good buddy, Dean McClellan. But the only time that I finally realized how this was such a great story in 2007, when the FDA slapped a black box warning, or its sternest warning, on this drug label, and I flew to Washington, D.C. to watch the national scandal unfolding in front of me at this huge public meeting, and that's when I realized, aha, Mark Duxbury is on to something. And so I immediately began reporting on this tale.
He was testifying.
He wasn't testifying.
Before Congress. Well, he did testify, didn't he?
He certainly sent lots of documents to Congress for several hearings. So, yes, he was in the thick of it then.
Now, why was he doing this? He was a successful salesman. He was making a lot of money from selling this drug.
Well, it's funny. They don't make a whole lot of money. I mean, maybe $100,000, which in this day and age is not a whole lot. But what really got Mark is that he realized that J&J was committing fraud. And that really bothered him. He was this type of person that couldn't go to sleep at night if he knew there was something wrong.
Well, so, he had believed in EPO at first, hadn't he?
He believed in it, and he was actually very proud of it. He thought he was doing good by doing well.
Now, how, after a few years after it was introduced, how much testing had actually been done on EPO? And was this something that salesmen had to deal with?
Well, actually, the salesmen were behind the phony studies on EPO. Mark and his sales reps were taught to go into doctors' offices and sort of mount these phony studies where they would inject or encourage doctors to inject the patients with high doses and then sort of scribble down what the reaction was. But one of the reps, Dean McClellan, realized many, many years later that he was slowly killing people, and this has horrified him. And that's, of course, why he joined the whistleblowing case.
Weren't the doctors noticing that people were dying?
No, they weren't. There weren't any solid, independent studies that showed the dangers of EPO until much, much later.
Well, I want to return to that after we take a little break. My guest is Kathleen Sharp, who is a journalist who's written for the New York Times Magazine, Parade, Elle, and Fortune, among others. She's also produced segments for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. And she has written a book called Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. It's published by Dutton. Stay with us. We're back to Kathleen Sharp, her book Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever, is published by Dutton. I want to get back to the whole business of testing because I'm really confused about this. It seems to me this drug is being sold. It's being touted as a miracle drug, and all the testing has not yet been done on it. Has there ever been a complete study? I thought you had to go through a long, complicated three-stage studies for drugs like this.
Well, you do, and that was in a very small patient pool, and that was at a very low dose. But you have to remember that both J&J and Amgen were out there upping the dose by about 33% when it was unapproved by the FDA and very risky.
When Duxbury was instructed by Ortho to market EPO for dialysis patients, was he aware of the fact that he was crossing over into Amgen's territory?
Well, he was, and he brought that up with his bosses, but they said, don't worry about it. You're selling them EPO, and what the doctors do with it is up to them. But that actually triggered the fierce feud between the two companies because Amgen was not about to let J&J go off with the dialysis market that it owned.
Well, there are a number of different kinds of treatments for kidney disease, aren't there? And kidney facilities all over the United States. Where does this drug fit into all of that?
Well, that's a great question, too, because this drug never claimed to cure anything. Dialysis patients before were getting blood transfusions to up their red blood cells, and this drug simply replaced that.
So it didn't cure anemia, and it didn't extend life?
No. Here's a drug that didn't work very well for a disease that never really existed. And it was, you know...
But it did make people feel better, didn't it?
It did, but so does a blood transfusion. So what happens, though, with blood transfusions is that they don't cause strokes and heart attacks, unlike EPO, which does.
And why would EPO? Because sometimes it just elevated the levels of hemoglobin to dangerous levels?
To such dangerous levels that your blood would turn to sludge and the heart would have a really hard time pumping it through the body.
So here we have Mark Duxbury being instructed to go out and sell this drug as an anemia drug. He's supposed to be selling it as a cancer treatment, although you suggested it wasn't all that effective there as well.
Well, it was effective if you wanted to up your red blood cells, but there were many other choices too.
Now, but okay, so how was he told by J&J to persuade doctors to switch from Amgen's drug to J&J's?
Well, they did that with money, which is, pretty much runs any industry. What Mark would do is go in and say, look, I'll give you free drug if you will use it for a month, and then I'll teach you how to bill Medicare for it. And if that didn't work, then Mark would then, or Dean McClellan also, would give a doctor a few thousand dollars to become an advisory board member, or they would send them to a beautiful vacation somewhere out in Arizona for a weekend.
What was Ortho's reimbursement assurance program?
Well, it had all kinds of fancy names for these sort of kickbacks and rebates. And as you pointed out, it was a form of money laundering, really.
Well, don't doctors have to disclose these contributions on their tax returns?
Well, perhaps they do. But what I learned while reporting Blood Feud was that this happened in almost every single pharmaceutical company you could name. And we've seen multi-billion-dollar settlements over the years from Pfizer and Eli Lilly for the exact same thing that J&J is now accused of doing.
Tell us about the relationship between St. Peter's Hospital in Olympia and the Memorial Clinic. What sort of treatment centers were they, and should J&J have been marketing to them in the first place?
Well, the Memorial Clinic, of course, was a dialysis clinic right across from St. Peter's, which was a hospital. And no, J&J and Mark Duxbury should not have been in there, but Mark was told to go in there by his boss. So what you have is a sales rep with a real strong conscience being told to not only go in and sell these things illegally, but being given a very high sales quota. And if he didn't, he would lose his job.
Yeah, but the marketing managers must have realized that somewhere down the line they might be subpoenaed and forced to testify about what was going on.
Well, if they did, they sure didn't act on it. And this was in the mid-90s when it was sort of go, go, go for businesses, especially biotech pharmaceuticals.
So when Mark Duxbury testified before an arbitrator, it was during an arbitration hearing. What did his testimony do for him in terms of job security?
Well, it pretty much annihilated his job security. Once he started telling the truth, J&J and his bosses sort of made his life a living hell.
Even though he'd been a record-setting sales rep, had been given a gold and diamond ortho ring?
That's right, yeah, a gold ring which he actually passed on to me.
So he was fired at some point. What was the official reason?
Well, the official reason was trumped-up charges. But more importantly, they sort of gave him the gloveless torture routine in which they continually squeezed him to achieve ever higher sales goals while taking away his sales prospects. And he eventually had a nervous breakdown.
And so he was fired. Was that when he began thinking about filing suit against Ortho?
Well, he didn't know about whistleblowing cases back then in 1998. He tried to file a wrongful termination suit, but J&J's attorneys were very successful in quashing that. He went on during the time of Enron to try and file a fraud, SEC shareholder fraud suit against J&J for not disclosing to its shareholders about this blood feud, but he was not successful in that. And it was really only until he ran into a whistleblowing attorney that he realized, aha, I can sue under the False Claims Act.
But whistleblowers have discovered, to their chagrin, that they're not always as well protected as the law would suggest.
No, in fact, it's really a hellish life and a huge uphill battle for whistleblowers. Only about 1% of them ever are successful.
You mentioned earlier that some athletes had been doping their blood with EPO, and that caused a scandal. How did the companies respond to that?
In oblivion, basically. They sort of ignored it. And in fact, there's this wonderful scene in the book in which Mark is watching the Tour de France and sees a Procrit commercial come on. And it's the irony of it is, of course, these bicyclists are probably doping themselves up while Procrit is saying, hey, this wonderful drug will make you feel better.
Now, when those Procrit commercials came on, were they filled with the same kinds of scary language that we see in so many of those commercials?
The very fast talking at the end where they, pretty much tell you about all the side effects. But actually, it was a very beautiful commercial with very lush music and gorgeous colors that made you want to get a shot of Procrit.
Kathleen Sharp is my guest. Her book, Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever, is published by Dutton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What did the FDA do to monitor Procrit's growth into the new markets and these new practices?
Well, the FDA heard about these fast and loose practices by both companies, and actually the staff wrote several letters telling J&J to cease and desist. But what happened in the Bush administration is that the president appointed a former pharmaceutical defense attorney to head the legal counsel at the FDA. So, of course, he would, tell the staff not to send out these letters. And that really killed morale at the FDA in regards to this drug.
This is despite the fact that it was obvious that studies were showing that increased EPO dosage in cancer patients led to increased chance of death and also tumor growth.
Tumor growth. Can you imagine being a cancer patient and hoping this will make you strong enough for chemotherapy when actually it's accelerating the growth of cells?
So the FDA actually approves a big increase in dosage of Procrit injections in 1996.
Actually, it was in 2004, but for those 7-8 years, J&J and Amgen were illegally gunning the needle, so to speak, on this drug.
How did Ortho use the approval? Were they told to complete studies about EPO and blood clots?
Well, they were, and so was Amgen. But we have to remember that a lot of these studies were done by the good buddy doctors that were being paid by Amgen and J&J. So, of course, these studies were going to have rosy conclusions about the great benefits of the high dose of this drug.
A caller wonders about the motivation factor for whistleblowers who commonly receive 20% of damages that are won in court.
Actually, they don't receive that much. Usually, the average is much lower, and by law, they can receive between 10 to 30%. And of course, I think in many cases, there is a financial incentive. Otherwise, you wouldn't go for 7 years or 10 years without a dime. But with Mark Duxbury, I can say that he was really eaten up inside by the idea that he had sold drugs that had really hurt people, and he couldn't sleep at night.
So he decided to mount a qui tam suit against his former employer? What does quitam
mean? Oh, it's a lovely Latin phrase, quitam, that actually stems from this idea from the 12th century English court that a peasant could come into the king's court and blow the whistle, so to speak, if he saw the lord stealing chickens from the palace. But that trans sort of migrated over to the United States during the Civil War when Lincoln formed the quitam law in the United States to come down on merchants who were selling sawdust as gunpowder to the Union Army. And of course, we saw that kind of have a new life during the defense era and now with the pharmaceutical companies. And it's quitam is really the False Claims Act, or the tool that whistleblowers use.
And he did get help from some of his former colleagues at Ortho.
He did, and his best buddy, Dean McClellan, was the one who really helped him by supplying about 15,000 documents to sort of bolster Mark's case.
And what was the thrust of Duxbury and McClellan's claim? How much money were they suing for?
Well, in quitam, or False Claims Acts, you don't initially set out to put a dollar amount, but Mark estimated that this case was worth $30 billion in fines and settlements and recovered taxpayer money. So we'll see what happens with that case.
And Jan Schlickman got involved in this?
That's right, another crusading attorney.
A man who they've made movies about.
Right, a civil action.
John Travolta played him.
Right, but Jan can't dance like John, I have to tell you. So Jan got the old fire in the belly once he heard about Mark Duxbury's case.
There had been other lawyers involved previously.
They weren't doing
as well?
Well, again, it's hard when you're suing against a huge company like J&J, which pays its attorneys $800 an hour, and you are not collecting any money until you actually win the case.
Well, is it easy to get information about the tests and what has actually been happening? How much is that closely held by the drug companies themselves?
Well, it is very closely held. But in this case, I think by the time Jan came in, a lot of stuff was bursting out into the public in the public realm. And you would find that the Wall Street Journal was writing about this. The New York Times was writing about it. So it was known that it was pretty much a dangerous drug.
And we were talking about illegal activities. And yet when the group submitted their case to the Department of Justice, the DOJ decided not to get involved.
Well, not yet. The DOJ can reserve the right and then jump in at the last minute. And so far, after, almost 8 years, the DOJ has not gotten involved, which is sort of amazing when you think of all the Medicare money that we could stand to gain from this.
Considering the fact that we're talking about two supposedly very different administrations involved, two very different departments of justice.
Well, we're also talking in a way about the very same thing, because both the U.S. Attorney General under Bush and the U.S. Attorney General under Obama worked for companies that defended J&J, law firms that defended J&J. So there's this revolving door, happens in both Republican and Democratic administrations.
Is this scandal a limited one, or are there other drugs that you could just as easily have written about?
There are, actually. This particular drug was the first biotech wonder drug, so it was very exciting in that way. But we've seen many drugs pulled off the market in the last few years. Avastin, a $100,000 cancer drug that it turns out doesn't work. Time and time again, this is happening.
And in most cases, what happens is the pharmaceutical company pays a fine and admits that it had done nothing wrong.
It usually doesn't admit any wrong.
I mean, it says we've done nothing wrong, but we're paying $800 million or whatever.
Right, yeah, which is, wouldn't that be nice if we could all do that?
But that didn't happen here.
Well, they still haven't the case still has not gone to court. But what we are seeing is that Amgen has put aside about $800 million to settle very similar whistleblowing claims against its EPO drug. And now we're waiting to see what will happen with J&J.
And is Schlickman still involved in the case?
Indeed he is. He's the crusader rabbit, the attorney who just won't give up. And he's appearing next week in Boston at the U.S. District Court to argue his case.
But Mark Duxbury won't be there.
No, unfortunately, Mark did not last. Whistleblowers, endure an incredible amount of stress, both financial stress, physical, and emotional. And he just couldn't take it and died about a year and a half ago.
Of stress?
Well, he had heart problems. He had anemia problems, ironically. And he also was given sort of a lot of prescription drugs, some of which counteracted each other. So he died in his sleep with Big Pharma coursing through his blood.
Oh, Is the assumption that Schlickman is going to win this case, or he is up against, as you said before, some pretty high-powered legal teams?
Well, now that we see Amgen putting aside a huge settlement, it'll be interesting to see what J&J decides to do. There's no doubt that the drug is deadly. There's very little doubt that J&J, illegally marketed this. So common sense would tell you that he will win.
Meanwhile, you have completed this book. Are there other scandals out there that are appealing to you?
Well, what really appeals to me is sort of the indefatigable spirit of these whistleblowers. And I, rather than scandals, I kind of like to concentrate on what these unsung heroes did. And really, Mark and Dean were very funny, witty men who truly wanted to do the right thing. So that was my focus.
Kathleen Sharp is a journalist who's written for The New York Times Magazine, Parade, Elle, and Fortune, among others. She's produced segments for National Public Radio's Morning Edition, has appeared and consulted on film documentaries for Turner Classic Movies, The Biography Channel, and Bravo, won several awards. And now she's written a book called Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. It's published by Dutton. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Leonard.